Okay, welcome everybody. Is everybody in now, Nina? Yes, yes. Welcome everybody to the Mandated Reporter Commission meeting, virtual hearing. I apologize for the slight delay in starting this meeting. I'm Chrissy Goldman from the Office of the Child Advocate. We are recording this meeting, so your participation in this meeting is your consent to it being recorded. So we will be audio recording this meeting. We also do have interpretation available in Spanish, Portuguese, and Haitian Creole. The way you choose that is at the bottom of your screen. You can choose your interpretation channel. If anyone has any concerns with that, you can chat with me via the chat function. If you are interested in testifying today, please send your name to me via the chat function. I am the host, and you should be able to chat me directly and put your name in the chat, and I will call you in the order in which you put your name in the chat. If anyone is participating by phone today, you could text the number 781-870-0432. Again, 781-870-0432 with your request to participate, and you'll be put in the queue for testimony. All testimony will be 3 minutes today. However, since we do have interpretation services, I am asking everyone to please speak slowly, and therefore I will give you slightly more than 3 minutes to present your testimony to account for keeping your pace slow enough for the interpreters to be able to interpret. If anyone has testified at the previous meeting, I will put you at the bottom of the queue for participating today, if I can remember your names. All right. I'm hearing from commission members that they should be identified. So the commission members are all co-hosts. They should be at the top of your screens if you're in the gallery view. I can pass it over to Maria, and she can perhaps give us a little introduction and introduce some of the commission members who are present today. You'll have to bear with me today as I work through the technology piece of this. And in the meantime, if I can ask Maria to do a little introduction to the work that we're doing today.
Okay, let me see if hopefully I will be able to everyone that's a commission member. I am Maria Masaitis. I am the director of the Office of the Child Advocate and chair of the Mandatory Reporter Commission. I will just name our commission members, unless you want to say something, in which case you can unmute yourself. So representing the Office of the Attorney General is Angela Brooks. Representing the Department of Early Education and Care is Ann Connors. Representing the Department of Children and Families is Christina Tedstone. Representing the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is Nina Marchese. And representing the Committee for Public Counsel Service is Lisa Hewitt. Have I missed any commission members? No, great, okay, that's it. I wanna thank everyone for joining us again today and join with the apology for our technical difficulties. We are looking forward to hearing from you. The commission wanted the opportunity to encourage individuals to comment on the draft that we have submitted for public comment. And our expectation is that once the comment period is closed, and that includes both written comments and the two virtual oral testimonies that we have opened, that information will be shared with all of the commission members, and that commission will then have an opportunity to digest and discuss the feedback that we have received. And then we will then proceed from there to decide how we are going to ultimately decide what recommendations that we will provide to the legislature. At this point in time, the Mandatory Reporter Commission is without a legislative authorization. Those are pending in the legislature, but we are proceeding in full compliance with the open meeting law as we are continuing while we wait for the legislative authorization. So I thank you again for joining us today. And we will, I'm now going to turn it back over to Chrissy Goldman.
Thank you very much, Maria. For the people who have titled themselves anonymous, if you could please put your retitle yourself as some type of fake name, because if there are multiple anonymous, I'm unable to tell who I need to unmute. So please take a moment to do that and retitle yourself. You can even write fake name one, fake name two, or fake name number if that's what you wish. One of our members will be holding up a sign at the 1 minute mark to give you a sense of 1 minute left. And like I said, I'll be giving you a couple more seconds than the 1 minute left so that you can speak slowly for the interpreter, excuse me. All right, so to anyone who just joined, your participation in this meeting, is your consent to the meeting being recorded? I'm going to find our first presenter and unmute them. Give me 1 moment, please. Okay, and you have 3 minutes.
You need to let the person know who it is.
They should know. They've unmuted yourself. Ann Eisner, you can go.
Thank you, Commission members, for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to share my experience as a mandated reporter and my concerns about the current proposal. My name is Ann Eisner. I'm the Deputy Director of the Trauma and Learning Policy Initiative, a joint project of Mass Advocates for Children and Harvard Law School. I am a social worker. Before joining my current organization in 2006, I worked for over 25 years providing and supervising home-based clinical services to high-need adolescents, children, and families. And it is that experience that I want to share with you today. We all understand that safety is foundational to a child's and adult's sense of well-being. Maintaining safety for our clients was our primary goal. Our master's level staff received training about the signs of abuse and neglect, and about the need to report when there was reasonable cause to believe that a client might be a victim of abuse or neglect. Further, through ongoing weekly supervision and case consultation, we addressed the more nuanced understanding about the need to differentiate parental neglect from the impact of economic instability or parental disability, and about the need to ensure that the staff were using a bias-free lens in their assessment of and work with parents. When a concern about potential abuse or neglect in a case was identified, we used a process for joint decision-making among the staff member working with the family, their supervisor, and our clinical director to determine whether filing a 51A was indicated. That discussion was based on careful discernment, was informed by professional wisdom, and by the particular context of each family, all guided by the definition of abuse and neglect in the law. All of these discussions about neglect included a consideration of whether the family's economic situation or parental disability was at play. These joint discussions also served to surface any unconscious bias that might be affecting the concern about abuse or neglect, enabling us to reach an informed decision about whether there was a need to report based on the facts of the case. I share these details about what this decision-making process among trained professionals can look like to highlight several points related to my grave concerns about the proposal to remove safeguards already in place. Based on my experience, I ask that you, one, do not remove the limitations based on poverty and parental disability in determining whether there is neglect. Those are critically important, as I just described, and must remain in place if we are not to become a state that piles more discrimination and harm onto those families already disproportionately impacted by the structural inequities of poverty and race. 2, I ask that you do not expand the list of mandated reporters. I have just described how professionals develop training and supervision that ensures nuanced understanding among staff, and how they establish joint decision-making processes where staff and supervisors discern together whether circumstances indicate a reason to file a 51A report. This leads to more informed decisions to file based on fact and not bias or opinion, resulting in fewer filings of unfounded reports that can cause irreparable reputational harm and add to the stress and trauma already experienced by vulnerable children and families. And 3, I ask that you do not replace the level of certainty needed to file a 51A report with suspicion. Without the clarity and guidance of the present definition, the implicit and unexamined bias inherent in opinion and suspicion will prevail, increasing immeasurably the disproportionate harmful impact of unnecessary and unfounded filings borne by families of color, families in poverty, and other vulnerable families. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Give me one moment, please. Does anyone have any questions for our speaker? Any commission members, excuse me, have any questions for our speaker? I'm having trouble seeing everyone, so please unmute. All commission members should be able to unmute themselves. Hearing none. Give me one moment. I am asking to unmute the next presenter. All right, Ms. Roberts, you are unmuted and you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, commissioners. My name is Dorothy Roberts. I'm a distinguished professor of Africana Studies, Law, and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of the leading book on racial inequities in the child welfare system, Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. The child welfare system in the United States is marked by stark racial disparities. Black, Latinx, and Native families are far more likely to be reported, investigated, and separated than white families. In Massachusetts, Black children and Latinx children are reported to DCF at twice the rate for white children. Black children are in foster care at 1.6 times, and Latinx children at 1.7 times their presence in the state populations. Black and brown children are more than twice as likely as white children to be taken from their parents and put in a damaging foster care system. Racial bias training can't eliminate the structural features of mandated reporting that lead to over-reporting of Black and Latinx children. There are people who try to justify these inequities by saying the child welfare system provides services to these families, but this is no social service system. It's a system that relies on terrifying marginalized families by taking their children away or threatening to in order to impose intensive surveillance and regulation on them and their communities. The vast majority of parents are reported to DCF because of allegations of neglect, not physical or sexual abuse. Most of these cases have to do with the parents' poverty and lack of resources to meet their children's needs. The conflation of poverty and neglect is written directly into state statutes that define child maltreatment. Neglect can mean living in an overcrowded home, wearing dirty clothes, or going hungry. Parents don't deliberately withhold needed resources from their children. Typically, they just can't afford them. And we can't solve this problem by reporting children to a system that responds by regulating families and tearing them apart rather than providing them with the resources they need. Mandated reporting actually drives parents from the very service providers that are most likely to support them. Many parents are deterred from fully engaging with healthcare, educational, and social service systems for fear the professionals who work there might support them. Might report them, not support them, because even baseless suspicions can lead to a terrifying encounter with DCF. Parents trying their very best to care for their children are often reluctant to solicit aid from social service providers who might report them. mandated reporting then thwarts the potential for schools, healthcare clinics, and social programs to be caring hubs of community engagement that non-coercively help families meet their material needs. It also wastes state funds spent on investigating baseless allegations, money that could have been invested in supporting children for their and their caregivers. For those reasons, I oppose the proposals in the draft report to expand who is a mandated reporter, lower the reporting threshold, and eliminate the poverty and disability exceptions from the definition of neglect. They will result in even more surveillance of Black and Latinx communities and will lead to more trauma, disruption, and barriers to support that already come with mandated reporting. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I'm asking any commission member if they're interested in asking any questions to please unmute themselves and go ahead and ask any questions of that presenter.
Chrissy, I have a quick question or comment. Professor, given the breadth of your work, if you have examples of systems throughout the country, county or state or otherwise based that you think are good models, for us to take a look at, if you wouldn't mind submitting them to the commission at some point in the near future, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
And do we have any other questions from commission members?
I was just going to ask the exact same question, so thank you. And thank you, Professor Roberts, for testifying today. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Give me a moment here. All right, I am unmuting our next presenter. And you can go ahead, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to share my screen in a moment. I'm Benjamin Levi. I'm a philosopher. I do work at Penn State University. I do work in human decision-making. I'm also a general pediatrician. I was the founding director of Penn State Center for the Protection of Children. And I'm currently the director of the I Look Out for Child Abuse program. Share this. I just provide a few things. So one of the things we know, that out of the way. One of the things we know is that in our current situation where child welfare is understaffed, under-resourced, and many of the cases are fraught with uncertainty, our implicit bias that we all carry often winds up just in the best of circumstances in indiscriminate reporting. And so what I want to do is present what I think are the three main needs. And those are to promote the right kind of reporting, to create a system that uses evidence-based training, and to provide clear, responsible policies and expectations. Right? We're told that this is a simple business, that when we have reasonable suspicion, we're supposed to report. I've done a great deal of research on this, and I asked this simple, fairly straightforward question. If you've encountered a child who has an injury or condition that might have been caused by abuse, you've gathered as much information as you feel is possible from the sources readily available, how likely would abuse have to be before you felt you had reasonable suspicion? Would you feel it had to be 99% likely, 1% likely, or somewhere in between? And the results that I've gotten, and this is with over 7,000 individuals, right, it's all over the board. So one of the things it means is that who you encounter on a given day, where they put the threshold at 30% or 80% depends upon whether you're getting reported. And that's true whether you're looking at community mandated reporters, pediatricians, or child abuse experts. And so what this tells me is that without a clear threshold, what we're really looking at is something that tells us more about the individual than about the threshold. So I think one of the things that's needed is first a clear threshold. And there's something problematic in what's being proposed because it conflates two things. The belief, one is a belief, which is the holding of an idea to be true, with a suspicion, which is a particular kind of feeling. And even more than that, it goes on to suggest that we should rely on our impressions. And the problem with mere impressions is that when you encounter a statement such as my dad beats me every day without critical thinking, you don't know whether it's with a belt or whether it's with chess, right? The second thing I think we need is we need something that will increase the signal that child welfare receives and decrease the noise, right? And removing consideration of the role of poverty and disability, I think, would flood the system by promoting indiscriminate reporting. And the reason for that is that unless every single facet of the DCF system is exemplary, it's not just unwise and unproductive, but I think it's unethical to encourage reports of any and all concerns that a child's needs are not being met. Systems work by having standards, right? And when in doubt, report, it's not a standard. It's an invitation for things to go badly, for serious collateral damage, despite the best of intentions. And that's because the very experience of being assessed can be devastating to families who are already hanging on by a thread. And given the policing power of child welfare, these changes, I think, would actually result in criminalizing poverty and disability. The third thing that I think is needed is to have better reporting, is to have evidence-based training that's been validated and shown to be effective. There are very few places where this is in place. And this kind of training should promote critical thinking, because when the stakes are high, what's needed is thoughtful, not thoughtless action. To be effective, child welfare needs people to know what to report, what not to report, and particularly how to make an effective report. Because if they're going to be referred information that they're supposed to take action on, they have to have good information. And that's why evidence-based training, I think, is critical for this. For those who are interested, we have a website that provides data from a study that's just coming out, comparing the mandated reporter trainings across the country. This is the website for it, and I'm happy to provide additional information. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. I'm asking any commission members whether or not they have a question for our last presenter. Please unmute yourselves. Okay, thank you. All right, and I'm going to ask to unmute our next presenter. And before we begin that presentation, I'd like to say, remind everyone that we're recording the meeting, or remind everyone that if you're interested in speaking, please enter your name into the chat directly to me as the host. I am not confirming via the chat that people are in line. If you've sent the chat to me, I believe I've gotten your name down. I want to remind the people who chatted as anonymous that they're going to have to go back in and change their name from anonymous, because we have several anonymous participators and I cannot unmute a participant with the name anonymous for whatever reason. If you are participating via phone, you can text 781-870-0432. Again, 781-870-0432. You're interested to participate, if you put your name in the chat, you do not also have to text that phone number. You're already in the queue. Sorry for taking up your time. Please go ahead. Well, you didn't take up your, I didn't take up your time, because you have 3 minutes. You can go ahead and testify.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. I am Virginia Benson, and I direct the Race, Equity, and Justice Project at the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. I am testifying today in furtherance of MLRI's goal to advance racial equity in the Commonwealth, and in support of and in conjunction with my colleagues in the Massachusetts Child Welfare Coalition and the Children's Law Support Project. I have some unsettling news. We all have biases against different social and racial groups that we are unaware of and that are not always in concert with our own convictions and beliefs. It is disturbing to discover that about ourselves, to say the least. But to safeguard against harm, our minds have evolved to make automatic positive, negative associations based on information we consumed over a lifetime through media, education, things we have read, observed, and heard. Our environments, our cultural attitudes and values leave an indelible imprint on our brains. Though we may have a conscious aspiration of being fair and neutral, we simultaneously are making unconscious judgments. And these type of unconscious judgments are why physicians will order skeleton scans significantly more for Black children with accidental fractures, why they will miss abuse and head traumas of white children more than non-white children. Black and other non-white parents are unconsciously associated with violence, lack of family values and humanity, and with benefiting from DCF intervention. That is a landscape in which you are working. Our country has a long history of separating non-white children from their parents, starting with Black children during slavery, Native American children to reform schools, Japanese children during internment, and most recently Latinx children at the southern border. So our decisions are influenced not by what we believe, but what we learn. And there's no scientific evidence that trainings eliminate implicit bias. Any trainings do what Gwyneth Paltrow coined an unconscious uncoupling of these associations. More importantly, there's no scientific evidence to support that such trainings will change anyone's behavior. That is not to say those trainings do not have value, because they do. But such trainings are not a substitute for real solutions and are not a sufficient way to address a systemic issue. You have already heard testimony about how these proposals will in fact exacerbate the racial disparities that already plague our child protective services. If policies or practices reinforce differential outcomes by race, then systemic racism exists. And no training will fix a systemic problem. No training will fix an injustice. I urge you not to adopt these proposals. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any commission members who have any questions for that presenter? Please unmute yourselves, commission members. And I do want to confirm that we're only allowing commission members to ask questions. Okay, thank you very much. And we'll move on to our next presenter. I am unmuting you now. And you have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike DeCita. I'm Deputy Chief Counsel with the Committee for Public Counsel Services. I oversee CPCS's Children and Family Law Division, which provides representation to all children in care and protection cases in Massachusetts. We also provide representation to indigent parents. I want to begin by addressing two proposals that we strongly support. First, social workers, physicians, psychologists, and other professionals play a critical role in the representation of CPCS clients in courts throughout the state. Massachusetts has long been a national leader in ensuring that people at risk of losing their liberty, including children in care and protection cases, are provided counsel. Treating experts retained by attorneys as mandated reporters is inconsistent with that right to counsel. So we urge the commission to endorse the proposal set out on page 18 of its report. Second, mandated reporters should be required to report, as they perceive them, the race and ethnicity of individuals about whom they are submitting a report. But while the commission has shown a commitment to racial justice in the context of data, it could end up making a system that is already rife with racial and ethnic disparities even worse. Independent of the expansion of the list of reporters, which itself is problematic, the proposed statutory changes would sweep even more children into a DCF system that already gets too many reports to manage the ones that truly require their attention. The proposed language would require, and we need to make no mistake, it would be a requirement that teachers, childcare workers, and other mandated reporters who come into contact with children would have to report to DCF whenever they have a reasonable cause to believe that children are at a substantial risk of having their needs not met because of poverty or the disability of a parent. Just focusing on poverty now, by definition, household poverty places children at a substantial risk of having their needs not met. So this proposal would subject every child, every poor child in the Commonwealth, to a report to DCF alleging that they are neglected. And because of the racial and ethnic disparities in wealth and income, That change alone will amplify the structural racism that's already present in the child welfare system. The commission must understand that while many reports protect children, every report places a child at risk of harm, from the trauma that's caused by investigation to the trauma that's caused when DCF removes children from their homes, often in the dead of night, and sends them to live with total strangers. We fear that the proposals that that are being considered are leading the commission to depart from its legislative mandate. That's evident from the introduction to the commission's report, which states that the commission was created, quote, to comprehensively review the statute to recommend systematic changes. But that's actually not true. The commission was created, quote, to review and report on existing mandated reporter laws and regulations and make recommendations on how to improve the response to and prevention of child abuse and neglect. The legislature has not asked for a systematic overhaul of the mandated reporter system, and they certainly didn't ask for one that would overwhelm an already troubled state agency or one that would exacerbate racial injustice in the state's child welfare system. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from commission members for that presenter? Okay, I'm going to move on to our next presenter. I will note that at this point, the list of people who are interested in participating is long. I am not confirming with every person who chats and puts their name on the list that they are in fact on the list, but if you did chat me, I am ensuring that your name is on our list. Again, if you are if you chatted me as anonymous, you're going to have to change your name and re-put your name on the list. It can be a name that doesn't belong to you, but I need a name to be able to find you and unmute you. I am going to unmute our next presenter. There you are, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, I am a foster adoptive parent of a 9-year-old boy with disabilities that stem mainly from a history of early trauma, as well as living in the foster care system in a lot of different homes from ages 2 to 4. And I want to tell you that I do not think the changes the commission is considering are going to help keep kids safe. All they're going to do is make things a lot harder for families like mine. When you have a kiddo like mine with serious disabilities and lots of service providers, unsafe behaviors and aggression, you get reported on a lot. If my kiddo tries to kick me in the face or strangle me and I move out of the way, he falls and gets a minor scratch or whatever, usually someone in the ER where we go to get him psych support feels the need to file a 51A. I don't remember how many times I've been filed on, but his special schools have been filed on several times too, as has one of the psych hospitals he's been in. The first time I was reported on, it was by a crisis team member in the ER. And honestly, I don't even remember what it was for. What I remember about that night was it was cold. My son was upset. He ran out of the house and was trying to run into traffic. It was terrifying, and I had to try to restrain him from running into traffic while we waited for an ambulance. What I do remember is being with him in the ER and having to go out of his room to cry in the hall. I cried for maybe 2 hours after I found out they were going to file on me. The ER doc comforted me and said the hospital did not support the report, but it was so painful to be reported on when all I was trying to do was to keep my son safe. The next time I reported it was by an adoption advocacy organization I went to get extra support. My son was having a really hard time and had been hospitalized a couple of times by then. We had an in-home therapist who was not a good fit for us. He told me I was being a bad mom because when my son, who was 6 years old, was having night terrors, I would let him fall asleep in my bed. I told the advocate what was going on in the hopes she could help me advocate for a better therapist. I told her we were having a hard time and what my in-home therapist had said about him falling asleep in my bed. And I also told her I was really worried about money. So I'm a single mom and I have a kid with serious disabilities. So how do I work? How do I support our family? She asked me what incomes, what my income stream was, and I explained I had been selling children's books at the neighborhood farmers market. She asked me if I brought my son, and I said, yes, of course. I also told her that sometimes I rented out our second bedroom on Airbnb because we really needed the money. We talked for a while, and I thought it was a good conversation, but then the next day, I got an email from her saying she had filed on me with DCF. I was devastated. Once you're filed on, schools, hospitals, group homes, and service providers look at you differently. Anytime a new provider learned that my son sometimes sleeps in my bed, they would file on me again. I kept trying to say, could you please talk to my son's other providers so you understand that he sometimes can't sleep? We are working on it in therapy, but it's a process. DCF has looked into this so many times before. I was also filed on more recently about my own medical condition. Because of my own disability, on the advice of my doctor, I occasionally take medical marijuana in gummy form. I have a med locker with a combination lock where I keep all of my son's and my medication. One day, I realized my son was behind me while I was opening it, and I worried he had seen the combination, so I tried to figure out how to change it. But before I figured it out, a few days later, he got into the box. He licked a gummy. I was able to take it away from him before anything else happened. When I called the company to find out how to...
I'm sorry to interrupt. You are out of time, so I just want to give you a chance to wrap up, but you are out of time.
Yes, I have like two small more paragraphs left. It turned out I couldn't change the combination. I had to get a whole new box. And it took me a few days to do it. So I was filed on because I hadn't been able to get a new med locker fast enough. It was awful. When DCF came to my house, I was trying to explain this is to manage a medical condition. And the DCF person asked me, so who takes care of your son while you're using? I felt so ashamed and anxious. I can't tell you how anxious I felt. I wasn't getting high, it was medicine. I only take it occasionally when I need to. I explained I've been trying to figure out how to change the combination and what did they think? I was doing all these things for my son and then I was gonna just give him a marijuana gummy. It's very upsetting. I feel like, you know, is anyone working harder for my child than I am? Like there's nothing DCF could even ask me to do because we're already getting every single service and all I do is ask for more. You don't know how it feels to love your child so much and put so much into them and have someone who doesn't even know you ask you, what do you do with your son when you're high? Thank you.
Thank you. Does any commission member have any questions for our last presenter? Please feel free to unmute yourself and ask your question. Okay. All right, I'm going to unmute our next presenter. There you are, and you have 3 minutes to testify.
Hi, I'm the grandmother of the child in question. I'm speaking today because I'm scared about the power that the individual mandated reporters have to abuse the system and to report families simply because they disagree with their choice rather than because abuse or neglect. This is what happened to my family. My grandchild, DJ, had been an only child for most of his life and always wanted a little brother. On the school bus one day, on the way to school, DJ saw a mother and another and walking with her child alongside the bus. He joked to the driver, look, he's cute. Can you go get him for me? DJ had been talking about this for years, and the monitor and the bus driver knew he wanted a little brother. One day when he was on the phone, he had gotten a new phone, and the bus driver took the phone from him to put Wi-Fi on it. She went into his Google and into his pictures, and she claimed that he had pictures of 3 and 4 year old nude boys. He did have pictures in his phone of little boys from an adoption site that he was showing to me that he wanted to adopt. His phone, there was a parental control filter on his phone as he was under 13 years old, and he could not search nude children. The social worker at DJ school received the report from the bus monitor. She in turn called DCF and accused me of neglect and sexual abuse. The year before, the same social worker was upset with me because I disagreed with the school psychologist's evaluation of DJ learning disabilities for his IEP. I requested a neurological exam as an independent educational evaluation. She objected and alleged in this DCF report a year later that I did nothing about DJ's evaluation when in fact we were on a waiting list 6 to 12 months long for Boston Children's Hospital. The day after the DCF worker was at my home for the charges, Boston Children's finally called to schedule the neurological exam. The social worker called me at work from the school, called me at work about her report and to say she had talked to the district attorney. I felt so sick to my
stomach. Are you there? Patty, we can't hear you.
I couldn't Patty. Stay up there.
Sorry. Patty?
Yep.
Can you go back a little bit? You glitched out. We couldn't hear the last few sentences. Please, thank you.
Do you know where it was?
Probably the last two sentences.
The day DCF was sent to my house?
Yes.
About thank the charges, you. Boston Children's finally called the next day to schedule the neurological exam. The social worker from the school called me at work to tell me about her report and to say that she had talked to the district attorney. I felt sick to my stomach. She said if he did this to someone, who did this to him? I had no idea what she was talking about. After that, I was scared to send DJ to school. I was scared DCF would pull him from school and send him God knows where. I couldn't stay at work for worry that DCF would take him. I would pick him up from school myself. It scared the hell out of me. I was sick to my stomach. I was throwing up, shaking all the time. After the DCF investigator finally came to my home, she said, I have seen this before. The social worker thought she could control you. And when you disagreed, she could control me. I disagreed and she filed a report. DJ heard that conversation at our house. And he didn't want to talk to the school social worker anymore after that. Even when she would say hello, he would roll his eyes to look away from her or roll his body down the wall to avoid her and would get thrown into the timeout room. I told the principal to keep her away from him and that DJ could talk to the other social worker. It turned out the mandated reporter wasn't even his social worker. What happened was totally wrong, and there were no repercussions for the social worker or the school. All of it has hurt DJ. My grandson doesn't even want to go to school, doesn't want to do his work, doesn't cooperate at all with the schooling because he knows what happened. They email me all the time, says he's not even trying. He loved school before, wanted to go and see his friends. He did his work. Now he says, why do I have to go to that building? He won't talk.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you are out of time. So if you want to do a couple sentences to wrap up.
Okay, so basically I don't want you to expand the net of mandating reporters.
Thank you. Do we have any commission members who have any questions for our last speaker? Thank you very much. I want to remind all participants that if you're interested in speaking, to please chat me, the host, directly with your name or a fake name of your choosing. I will allow our next person to speak, but I just want to note that if you are participating via phone, you can text your name to 781-870-0432. If you have put your name in the chat, you do not also need to text. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to unmute our next presenter. There you are, and you have 3 minutes. Yes.
Okay. I did not kind of expect that. Hi. My story is that my daughter is 7 and she has a light case of autism. She was doing remote learning and that was definitely a struggle. And we have tight corners in our house. And one day she thought that I stepped on her foot like on purpose. And I didn't, it was an accident. And she open-handedly slapped me in the face. So it was on camera because of the school. And all of a sudden I get, you know, she reacted and, you know, and because she reacted, that's how she reacted, was open-handedly slapped me in the face. And the school reported me to DCF. She is in therapy and she is back in school full time and she is moving forward and doing much better. She's in counseling, but at the time she was going through a lot because she did not want to do the work. She was very obstinate about staying home. She didn't want me to teach her. She wanted to be in school. She made that well known. She had a one-on-one. She even grew to not want to do the work with a one-on-one. Even with the teacher, she loved her teacher and it was just, she's an only child. So she wanted the socialization. And she definitely just did not want it from me. So be that as it may, that is what happened there. But I was very surprised when I called one day and they said, we are reporting you. And I'm like, why? And they said, because she hit you. And I'm like, really? So anyway, she's doing a lot better. And that's not okay that she hit me. She's in counseling. We are addressing those issues. My husband and I are going through a separation now, a divorce. That was homeschooled. Obviously, I already addressed that she does not like it. She's back on track and she's much calmer because she is very good when she's around other people and she likes the socialization. And I'm looking into a YWCA program and I do not believe in expanding the mandating reporting thing because I don't like that in the sense that, you know, I felt that could have been handled better at the school. I just don't agree with that action because they even said you didn't do anything wrong. You're a very loving mom, but you know, she hit you. And I'm like, I was there. I know. So I just, for that reason, I just, that's it.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Do we have any commission members who have any questions for that speaker? Please feel free to unmute yourselves. Okay, thank you very much. I'm gonna pick our next presenter here. There you are, you're unmuted. Yep, go ahead, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Laura Sternberger, and I am the Director of Pregnant and Postpartum Women's Services and the manager of the Massachusetts Moms Do Care Project at the Institute for Health and Recovery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I am here today because I want to request and support the commission's idea and recommendation of a two-track reporting system or a screening system for the Department of Children and Families when screening the families of substance-exposed newborns. Our project, which is statewide, works with families, particularly pregnant and postpartum and parenting mothers, who have accessed early recovery for opioid use disorder, many of whom have engaged or are taking medication for opioid use disorder. At this time, all of those women are subject to a report to the Department of Children and Families. The statute is worded such that most hospitals or social workers working with families of children who've been exposed in utero to substances are required to report to the Department of Children and Families. Many of these families already have a lot of support. Many of the women that we're working with are stable on medication for opioid use disorder and have a great deal of support in their recovery and good relationships with their treaters. We would like to support the Department of Children and Families renewing their practice that they had in 2012 to create a screening process for those those families are screened out if they are stable and if they are working with their providers and utilizing medication for opioid use disorder as treatment for their opioid use disorder in the same way that people who are receiving treatment for diabetes or heart disease are stable on their medications. We found that in 2012, when the Department of Children and Families began to pilot this two-tiered program, we found that engagement with families was much easier because, as so many people have stated here today, the experience and the threat of reporting to DCF and some of the health inequities and disparities with regard to those reports are profound, especially now, even more exaggerated. So I support the reinitiation of the two-track reporting process for families of substance-exposed newborns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any commission members who wish to ask any questions of that speaker? Okay, thank you very much for your participation. I'm going to move on to our next presenter. Okay, I'm unmuting our next presenter. There you are, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Mary Viano. I currently live in central Massachusetts as an adopted mother of three young adults with significant trauma and disabilities and currently raising a grandchild. I work in the advocacy nonprofit world and partner with many state organizations, but today I'm testifying on behalf of myself and the concern of the mandating reporting proposal. I recognize the need to have mandated reporting and especially believe the child abuse is of concern. My lens as a parent of a child with significant needs and supporting many families like mine, I've seen concerns that I would like to highlight as concerning in the proposal. Oh, I'm going too fast. My apologies.
Yes, yeah, a little bit. So if you could slow down a little, I'll make sure you have a little extra time.
Oh, my daughter's coming. Okay. So it's my experience that post-adoption families are impacted by having 51As filed that are unnecessary that have resulted, sorry, my daughter's in the background, in the loss of jobs due to the filing, even if not supported while having children that have trauma. My experience has been affected by mandated reporting and investigation when a person has not understood the needs of children I have, resulting in multiple unnecessary filings. The filings were done based on suspicion and had not followed up with conversation for reasonable cause. I believe the training is crucial to all that are mandated reporters and to include and recognize further training on trauma-related challenges and specific training on implicit bias and prejudice. If reporters would have inquired more and understood additional information, they would have realized that I had multiple supports. I also am fortunate not to have had challenges with food, clothing, or shelter. I have the ability of a large family who has resources to support those needs. I do not see how the commission will hold these things accountable if people with severe poverty, distress, when they're trying to hold together a job as a single parent or grandparent in a family of limited resources. I would ask for the look at the poverty description, and specifically due to the pandemic, look at the intense food insecurities that families are going through today. I also believe, and it would be unlike me not to mention the concern of racial disparities in reporting to the child welfare community, specifically of concern. The child welfare and juvenile justice system have a higher rate of children and families of color, where the intellectual and mental health systems do not take custody away, yet have significantly less amounts of children that receive supports from those departments. I believe that intervention with resources and collaborative approaches would help families. Lastly, it's my concern of additional mandated reporters, specifically of mentors that work with children who are significantly green in the field and do not understand children with significant behavioral and mental health concerns. I appreciate the hard work in the commission and understand that we need to make sure that child abuse does not happen and it's reported correctly. I do believe that in my family, mandated reporting and lack of training and understanding has become a challenge, and it's caused unnecessary trauma, pain, and blame to my family. I look forward to the decisions and appreciate your hard work. And I ask you to really consider Dr. Levy and Dr. Roberts' testimony today, and specifically think of what would you want to happen to your family. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any commission members have any questions for our last speaker?